And here we are at the Nahum Segal Network. We call it By the Book. First run Tuesdays at 10 a.m. right here at the Nahum Segal Network. JMNAM.org, NahumSegal.com. Our thanks to our friends at Koren Publications. You can go to KorenPub.com for information about all their amazing releases. And today we're going to be discussing the brand new revised edition of the Reference Guide to the Talmud. Rabbi Adin Evan Yisrael Steinsaltz's Reference Guide to the Talmud is an indispensable resource for students of all levels. The editor of the newly revised edition of the Reference Guide to the Talmud is Rabbi Joshua Schreier. He's the editor of this edition and serves as executive editor of the Koren Talmud Bavli. He made Aliyah in 1982, after which he taught at Shivat Oel Shlomo in Be'er Sheva for 7 years. He and his family moved to Efrat in 1989, at which point he began teaching in Midrashat Lindenbaum in Yerushalayim, where he taught for 22 years. He has a B.A. in History and an M.S. in Jewish Education from Yeshiva University and received his rabbinic ordination from the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. Rabbi Joshua Schreier, welcome to the Nahum Segal Network.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you. There have been assorted aids to the Talmud, whether it be Talmudic dictionaries, different things that were geared to different age groups, whether it be high school and college students or older people when it comes to reference guides to the Talmud in the past. This one, however, is unique. What is it that makes Rabbi Steinsaltz's Reference Guide to the Talmud so different?
First of all, you mentioned that there were these aids in the past or these reference guides in the past. Well, Rav Steinsaltz first came out with his Hebrew edition of the reference guide called Madrich LeTalmud in 1984, which I guess, I mean, to you and me, it's present, it's current events, but I'm
right.
Saying it's...
For us, it's this generation.
In 1989, in the framework of the Random House publication of the Steinsaltz Talmud, this was translated into English and expanded. Since then, I believe that if you go on to one of the websites where they sell these things, the old one is a collector's item.
Right.
Because there just aren't that many to be had. So the people at Steinsaltz here in Israel, headed by Rav Steinsaltz, of course, and his son, Rav Meni Steinsaltz, Evan Israel, who is the director of the Shefa Institute, they decided there was time to come up with a new one, and we've been working on it, and thank God it finally has come to fruition and it was published.
And in what way?
What's unique about it? I think it's comprehensive nature.
Mm-hmm.
Comprehensive nature in terms of not, meaning it's not like a glossary in the sense that every word that you'll encounter in the Talmud is translated here. But it gives you, I mean, I'm opening up to the table of contents. It's divided into three parts. The first part is what we call historical background.
Mm-hmm.
Life in the Talmudic period, Jewish communities, generations of Tanaim and Amoraim, to give you some historical perspective of what we're dealing with. The next part, which is the longest, the most comprehensive part, has to do with, it includes Aramaic language section, it includes a glossary of basic words, which is brief, Talmudic terminology, which is much more extensive. In addition, Mishnaic methodology, principles of Talmudic hermeneutics, meaning that these are listed not merely with a translation, but with an expansion, which, again, I believe brings something to the table that you won't find in most reference books.
A lot of interesting parts. One of the things you mentioned earlier, which caught my ear, was this revolution. I think you could call it a revolution, if I remember correctly as a kid, when Random House wanted to actually publish a Talmud, right? That was on many different levels, that was a very significant step in Talmudic literature, would you say so?
Well, since from Sansino through Random House, there was no real attempt to publish the Talmud in English. Unfortunately, Random House only published four tractates, four Masechtot, which were, I think, constituted 20 volumes. One can only imagine how many volumes the whole Talmud would have taken. But certainly it was a major step in coming up with a modern translation. I mean, it's much more than a translation because it's based on Rav Steinsaltz's Perush, but right. a modern English version of the Talmud.
But I'd have to assume in this case as well, when it comes to the original reference guide to the Talmud, it was never done with a Random House audience in mind. Is that a safe assumption to make?
Well, again, it's hard for me to say, but it certainly. Let's put it this way: it was published. The major difference between the Random House version and the version that we just published now,
right,
is the version that we published now is accessible to the English speaker.
Right.
For example, in Random House, all of the key sections in which Hebrew language or Aramaic language was included were written in Aramaic or Hebrew alphabetical order.
Mm.
So in that sense, I agree with you. Your standard Random House audience would not really, know where to begin when you're looking for some sort of concept. And, where do you begin to look?
Right. Understood.
We've changed that. And in this edition, in three major sections of the work, the Mishnaic methodology, the principles of Talmudic hermeneutics, and especially the longest section of the book, Halachic Concepts,
right,
those are in topical rather than Hebrew alphabetical order,
right,
making it more accessible to the uninitiated.
Understood. Rabbi Joshua Schreier is with us, editor of the brand newly revised edition of the Reference Guide to the Talmud. It must be fascinating. I think we had this discussion with Rabbi Weinrib at one point because of the work he had done with Rabbi Steinsaltz. I don't know to what degree you have to work directly with Rav Steinsaltz when you're doing a project like this. But if, in fact, I could assume that you must, what is that experience like academically? I'm not asking you if he's easy to work with. I'm asking from academician point of view, what is that experience like?
Well, unfortunately, I don't get to meet with him that often. And he's there more as an inspiration, someone to consult with when, we have a difficult matter, whether it's procedural or content that we have to discuss. But he's a fascinating individual. The first time I met Rav Steinsaltz, again, after I began working on this project, and while I was working on the Talmud, and he asked, how's it going? And I said, Bezrat Hashem. So he quoted the Baal HaTanya, who said that only after you've exhausted all possible human effort can you say Bezrat Hashem. Until that point, leave the Kodesh Baruch Hu out of it. Again, I'm not quoting him word for word, but that was the basic idea. He's a very, very sharp, very incisive and very good sense of humor as well. But it's always very interesting when we get a chance to work with him.
I could only imagine. There is, in the very first section of the book, we're calling it the Reference Guide to the Talmud, Rav Adin Eben Yisrael Steinsaltz. It's referred to as the Indispensable Talmud Study Aid. There are chapters that talk about Mishnaic methodology and Talmudic methodology. Is there a way to explain to somebody who's unfamiliar with both what the vast differences are?
Well, actually, one is Mishnaic methodology and one is Talmudic terminology.
Correct, right.
Yeah. The Mishnaic methodology is divided into three basic parts. Again, remember, in the Random House edition, this was in Hebrew alphabetical order, so
right,
it wasn't divided conceptually at all. Here it's divided into tools for interpreting the Mishnah. The Mishnah, by its very nature, is cryptic. The Gemara works on expanding on the cryptic ideas mentioned in the Mishnah. So therefore, when you're approaching the Mishnah per se, this guides you into how to deal with certain concepts that you encounter there. Certain methodology that the Mishnah uses in writing these cryptic phrases. A second section has to do with rulings. What does it mean when the Mishnah says chayav or patur as opposed to mutar va'asar?
Right.
And those are just, you know, a few examples. In addition, there's in general the language of the Mishnah. When the Mishnah uses certain phrases, what is it that the Mishnah is trying to say? Now again, if you're learning the Mishnah together with the Gemara will very often expand on these. But if you're learning just the Mishnah, it's very important to be able to pick up on the allusions, the hints that you find in the Mishnah in order to come up with a more comprehensive understanding.
Often you need the Talmud's terms to explain the Mishnah's methods.
Well, okay, granted. But the thing is, when you're learning a Mishnah, those Talmudic terms don't appear.
Right.
Meaning when you're learning the Mishnah as a Mishnah. The Talmudic terminology obviously deals with the language that you find in, also in the Mishnah, but primarily in the Gemara, which is, obviously it's much more than an interpretation of the Mishnah, but that's certainly its jumping off point.
Understood. Talking about the reference guide to the Talmud revised edition from Rav Steinsaltz, it's a Koran release, as we discussed it with Rabbi Joshua Schreier, its editor of the brand newly revised edition of this reference guide to the Talmud. In terms of it being a dictionary, and I cited earlier at the beginning of this conversation that there are dictionaries out there. There are certain students on different levels of Talmud study that keep some type of dictionary or study aid by their side for the obvious reasons. Does this serve that purpose as well?
As I mentioned before, it certainly serves that purpose, but it does not pretend to be an exhaustive list of all the terms that you'll encounter. Meaning this doesn't replace any of the standard dictionaries that one might use,
right.
But this certainly includes, I would say, 80%, 90% of the terms that you'll encounter, the terms that are most often used.
Because you included, you know, life in the Talmudic period, Jewish communities of the time, all this historical background in part number one of the book, it would seem somewhat also to serve not only for those who are somewhat familiar with Talmud, but if somebody is completely unfamiliar with Talmud, this would give them, I don't know, I don't want to, God forbid, say a novel in the literary sense, idea of what Talmud's all about and where it fits into Jewish history, but in many ways it could serve for that purpose.
Again, when it was first published, it opened a window to the uninitiated, for
right.
Sure. And as I mentioned before, what we tried to do was to make it that much more accessible to the uninitiated. Someone who has no Talmud background at all could open the book, begin with the sections that you just mentioned, and to get a sense of the world of Talmud. And then, I mean, let me just bring an example. On page 431 in the reference guide, and this is representative of the of what we did with the halachic concepts section. There's a section called overriding factors.
Right, I see it.
Now, if you take a look, just don't look at the English for a second. If you take a look at the Hebrew for a second, you have Kvod HaBriot, Tikkun HaOlam, Darchei Noam, Darchei Shalom, Derech Eretz, Pikuach Nefesh, Kiddush Hashem, Tzar Balei Chaim, and Batlat Dato Etzel Kol Adam.
You can have volumes on each one.
Now, in the old version, there would be nothing bringing these concepts together. You would go from Kaf to Taf to Dalet. There are few in Dalet. Pei, Kuf. This way, what we did was we took these concepts, which are overriding factors, meaning in the category of positive mitzvot, overriding factors that can overrule or supersede positive mitzvot. And we have Kvod HaBriot, we have Tikkun HaOlam, human dignity, improvement of the world, ways of pleasantness, etc. So therefore, if someone with no background at all approaches this work and just leafs through the halachic concepts section is divided into seven sections, based on the sixth Sidrei Mishnah plus a seventh miscellaneous section. So if he just happens to pick any section at random and wants to research a topic, obviously it's not exhaustive because, you know, these topics could go on forever. But he wants to get a sense of what's included in that topic. Right here you have a, you know, something which opens a door that was previously closed.
I am so glad you pointed out this section to me, because we have certain categories, obviously, when it comes to our tradition, whether it's Aseh and Los Aseh, whether it's Ben Adam Lamakam, Ben Adam Lachavero, but the list that you just read, I would never have put into a common list until you went ahead. And what do we call it? We call it overriding factors, which I think is quite a title in the 21st century.
These are super halachic.
Right.
These are I mean, if you take a look around there, you have before it
the national affiliation. I love
man and his maker.
Right.
Positive mitzvot between man and his fellow man.
Right.
Halachic categories of positive mitzvot, prohibitions between man and his maker. We have the categories that you mentioned, but within that right. We have this.
I love the national affiliation one. Who would think of putting these items together as those that are such keys to our national affiliation, to the collective destiny of our people?
Sure.
It's amazing. Well, again, Rav Steinsaltz's leadership, right? This is his vision.
Of course.
He's a different type of thinker than others. So which Jewish communities are key? I mean, obviously, anybody who's somewhat familiar with Talmud could obviously answer this question, but there may be listeners out there who are just being initiated to all of this through this conversation. Which Jewish communities have to be pointed out when you give a historical background of the Talmud?
I mean, clearly, nowadays it would be Teaneck, right?
Very good. I thought you might say Muncie, or Lakewood, for that matter.
Well, being a Brooklyn boy, you know. But here also, in the Random House edition, these were listed in alphabetical order. Here, it's divided into Eretz Yisrael and Bavel,
right,
and into Judea and the Galilee and. I mean, obviously, you begin with Judea, and you go into, B'nai Brak's listed before Jerusalem, which I'm sure there'd be, you know, a nice controversy here in this country about which comes first. So Jerusalem has a much much longer entry. But the point is, you know, dividing them geographically. Obviously, when you're talking about the key places, you begin with Yerushalayim, you move on to Yavne, which is where the Sanhedrin went thereafter. And the various other places in which from Yavne it went into the Galilee, to Usha, and to Tveria, and to Beit Shearim, and to Tzipori, and etc. And these are all, crucial to understanding the development of the Mishnah and of the Jerusalem Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi. In Bavel, of course, I mean, there are certain cities that are more familiar and certain cities that are less familiar. I mean, Baghdad appears here, even though it's not something you find mentioned all that often in the Talmud, but obviously Sura, Pumbedita, Neherda, and these are the places where the Talmud Bavli came into being. And, of course, various other cities are mentioned in that context as well.
I've asked this to other guests in other contexts, especially when discussing history, but is there a way to describe the reasons that the Talmud Bavli has gotten to first place, let's put it, when it comes to Talmudic scholarship as opposed to the Jerusalem Talmud? Is it simply because either in terms of quantity or maybe quality, there was just a different type of scholarship going on outside of Israel at the time?
There are a number of different approaches to this question. I think the reason the Talmud Bavli is the senior Talmud, so to speak,
right,
is simply because Judaism developed in the Golos.
As we know it today, developed in the Golos, right?
No, meaning from the time of the Talmud Bavli, through the time of the Gaonim, through right. the Rishonim, through the Achronim, the Shulchan Aruch, this was, it developed in the Golos. I mean, also, the fact is, and this can't be ignored, the Jerusalem Talmud was redacted 200 years before the Talmud Bavli, and therefore the Talmud Bavli was, it was finished later, and therefore it was more widely accepted. It's very interesting. Rav Goren, Zichrono Livracha, one of the attempts that he made, I don't know to what degree he was successful, was he tried to say, now that we're back in Eretz Yisrael, we should put more of a focus on the Talmud of Eretz Yisrael.
Right.
And, obviously you can't undo 2,000 years of the development of Torah, but or 1,500 years, but that was his attempt.
Rabbi Joshua Schreier is with us, editor of the brand newly revised edition of the Reference Guide to the Talmud, an amazing work of Rav Steinsaltz. He's editor of this edition, has worked on the Koran Talmud Bavli. One of the notes that was given to me in regard to our conversation today is that that in fact Masechet Sukkah, the tractate that's being studied now in Daf Yomi, and we know that Daf Yomi, the one page a day a Talmud study, is very, very popular. One folio per day, I guess, would be more accurate. That is a perfect example of how this book can help as a resource. What would you say to someone who's studying Masechet Sukkah if they wanted to go ahead and pick up this reference guide?
Well, again, if you go to the, just one second,
no problem.
If you go to the table of contents of the reference guide, and you see the
page 274,
the halachic concepts section, Moed would be on page 256.
Right.
The table of contents of Moed is 256. So if you go to page 256, you have, beginning with Shabbat, divided into subcategories, festivals, and on page 272, you come to Sukkot. And there you have Sukkah, casual incidental meal, lower the partition, meaning the halachot having to do with the structure of the sukkah, which, by the way, is what took up most of the first two chapters, at least roughly the first chapter and part of the second chapter of sukkah. And then now, I believe the daf today is actually tomorrow, right? 36. Right. Lamed Vav is tomorrow, I think. I get confused.
No problem. We got you.
Okay. Anyway, and then you move on to the Arba Minim. Lulav HaGozel is the parak that's being studied now. And there you have the four species. And it's interesting, if you notice in the table of contents, two of the species are transliterated and two are translated.
Right.
And just in general, in terms of Talmud, in terms of editing the Talmud, in terms of setting the policy for the translation of the Talmud, it's always... our default is translation, meaning we always prefer translation to transliteration.
But the word lulav is not translated.
That's right, because lulav would be translated as a palm branch. And in the course of Masechet Sukkah, there are some palm branches that are used as a lulav, and some palm branches that are used as slach, and some palm. So therefore, palm branch would not be specific enough.
Wow.
Etrog and citron, I think that's simply because citron is something which is just, people wouldn't know a citron if it hit them on the head. So therefore, in terms of myrtle branch and willow branch, I have to admit something to you about my experience with trees and the Talmud. Trees that are mentioned in the Talmud in Aramaic and translated into Hebrew and then translated into English, those are three languages that I can't identify them. I mean, part of it is because, as I mentioned before, I'm from Brooklyn. There was one tree that grew in Brooklyn, and they wrote a book about it. It's not that.
So is it possible? You know, is it possible that we have the wrong translation for an Arava or for a Hadas?
People who do know the difference between trees were consulted, and this is...
then they know.
Yeah, I rely on them. If it was up to me, it would certainly be possible.
And the upcoming holiday of Purim, especially, I would guess, in your area of the world, one of the great discussions is when Megillah should be read. This year, of course, a lot would be involved if someone decided that their city should be reading it on the 15th as opposed to the 14th. of Adar. Is it a walled city or not? All these discussions, which I guarantee you are going to come up at almost everybody's Shabbos table this coming Shabbos, if in fact their kid is in a responsible elementary school, are discussed here in the holiday section.
Yeah, sure. I mean, here Purim is only three entries, but right. One of them being the Arba Parshios, the four portions of the Torah that we read, and the walled cities, and the difference between the walled cities and the unwalled cities. I mean, we're in the middle of Sukkah now, but the next Masechta is Beitza and Rosh Hashanah,
right.
Which is, our volume came out several weeks ago, I think actually about 6 weeks ago, and the Tanit Megillah volume should be hitting the markets. If it hasn't yet, it should be out in the markets any day now.
Have you worked on any tractate more than others, or you're across the board when it comes to this Talmud project?
My job as executive editor is to, together with others, I mean, clearly Rav Steinsaltz and Rav Weinrib are more in the macro,
right.
Meaning in terms of consulting them, kol ha-davar ha-gadol yiviyun aleihem, right?
Right.
We take the great questions to them. But in the day-to-day, as executive editor, I work primarily with three people, Rabbi Jason Rappaport, who is the managing editor. It's his job to keep all the balls in the air, where we have a staff of, I would imagine, 40 people. Including translators, editors, copy editors, reviewers, etc. Rabbi Josh Amaru, who is the coordinating editor, who is in charge of hiring the new people, in charge of working with them, and I work very closely with him in coming up with coinages, you know, for translation.
Right.
And Rabbi Abisha Magenza, who I believe you interviewed together with Rabbi Berger several weeks ago, who is the content curator, and he is primarily responsible for getting the background material right, meaning there's a lot of science and nature, and he's also responsible for the beautiful pictures that you find in the Talmud. So together with working with them, you know, in a managerial point, I work on certain masechtot. I mean, when this project started, I was basically doing everything myself, and then we realized that that's not going to work, so we had to expand. But, I mean, I did all of Brachot myself. I did the first volume of Shabbat myself. Myself together with the copy editors,
I mean.
Copy editors headed by Aliza Israel and Ita Olesker, together with a bunch of others who are, between you and me, the most important people in the.
Yeah. Do you get amazed at their abilities? You know, when you sit in my chair and you speak to some of the people that you've mentioned, or if I get a chance to speak to some of the people that you mentioned, it's mind blowing for me to see what their level of scholarship is. Do you get the same feeling when sitting with
them? I'm always very impressed. I mean, you know, the people often wonder, I'm going to digress for a second.
Sure.
People wonder, why is it that Yitzchak loved Esav? So there are all sorts of opinions, Midrashim, whatever
right.
it is. I think in general, you tend to admire people who can do things that you can't.
Good point.
Yitzchak saw Yaakov, Ishtam Yoshev O'alim, he said, yeah, I do that also.
No big deal.
Esav, this is exciting. This is something I can't do that. You know, it's not. I don't know if it's pshat, but certainly when you know I encounter some of the. I mentioned Rabbi Berger, the senior content editor,
right.
Who also works very hard at embellishing and adding and to the background notes, and you know, very key. He and his staff contribute a lot to the. To the project.
Well,
In terms of, Sukkah happens to be a Masechet, one of the few Masechet that I actually edited from beginning to end.
We are speaking with Rabbi Joshua Schreier. The topic is the newly revised edition of the Reference Guide to the Talmud. He is the editor, and it is an amazing work. It is called the Indispensable Talmud Study Aid, and of course it is the product of Rabbi Adin Evin Israel Steinsaltz. The reference guide is available from Koren Publications, korenpub.com, korenpub.com. We call this segment By the Book. We have a few minutes left with Rabbi Schreier as we discuss this amazing work. The book, by the way, is available, and I do remind you that in general, Magid Books is dedicated to bridging the dialogue between religious Israeli scholars and the American Jewish community. Magid Books authors include Rav Amital, Rav Steinsaltz, Rav Binyamin Lau, and many more. Ask about Magid Books in your local Jewish bookstore. They are an imprint of Koren Publications, and they are an amazing resource for great material. We're talking about the newly revised edition of the reference guide to the Talmud and some of the things that you will discover when you pick it up, including the historical background, which includes the Jewish communities that we spoke about earlier, the study of the Talmud section, which is dedicated to the actual study of the Talmud with the glossary, with the methodology, the terminology, et cetera, and the halachic concepts and terms, which we referred to earlier when discussing Purim and Pesach, Purim and Sukkot, rather, during our conversation here with Rabbi Schreier. Is there a, one of the discussions that often comes up in my home is the fate of history. Rashi, for instance, being in the, I don't know, should we say right place at the right time, that he is the, that he is the commentator. He is the one who traditionally is viewed as the most important comments when studying the Talmud. Then in general, the format of the Talmudic page. Now, I know you go through it in terms of showing somebody who is or is not familiar what they're going to find in a typical Talmudic page. Do you also discuss how those like Rashi and Tosfos became prominent enough in that specific generation to be included on the Talmud page?
There certainly is. I don't know if we deal with that aspect per se, meaning clearly the just in terms of Rashi, I think everyone agrees that Rashi earned his way onto the page, meaning how can you learn without Rashi? I mean, it's just Tosfot, on the other hand, I think he benefited from being in the right place at the right time, because if Tosfot wasn't on the page, I mean, for example, in Maseches Nedarim, where Tosfot is a relatively minor commentary and the Ran is the major commentary across the page from Rashi, it's a whole different experience. And, you know, Tosfot is the depth of Tosfot's analysis is amazing. But, you know, one could certainly get through a Daf Gemara, at least on the basic level, without Tosfot as well.
Right.
So I'm saying Rashi, I don't think there's any question that he, no matter who published it or have whatever history, Rashi would find his way to the forefront. Tosfot, you know, with all due respect, I don't know that he would have been as indispensable.
So it's all about placement, huh?
But, I mean, listen, location, 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 right? In the section following the, on page, where are you? We have on page 76, there's a sample page of the Talmud.
Right. That was what I alluded to. Kafei
Amud Aleph in Masechet Megillah, actually.
Right.
Which is marked up with various numbers.
Correct.
And the section following that, you have the layout of a Talmud page.
Correct.
And if you look, beginning on page 81, mm-hmm. there you have Rashi's commentary.
Right.
Right? Where there's a... talks a little bit about the development of Rashi's commentary and how it developed, and then is followed by Tosfot and et cetera, several more pages of the Mefarshim that appear on the Daf,
for those,
on the Daf and in the back.
For those of us who always thought that Rashi had a unique script for whatever he felt the need, is it simply that that was the script of the day, and that those who were responsible for replicating works, that's how they would write?
Apparently, Rashi wrote in standard Hebrew letters. When Rashi was added to the Daf of the Gemara, in order to differentiate between Rashi and the Gemara, they started writing Rashi in a different font, and that became the Halakha Perush Rashi, the Halakha Rashi print, which, by the way, we do have in the reference guide.
Right, it's in the back.
A... on page, where are you? On page 499.
All right.
We have a chart with Rashi's print as opposed to, it's actually on page 500.
Right.
501? Yeah, 501. Rashi's print as opposed to the regular print.
So when
with all the new publications coming out, I wonder, you know, how much longer Rashi print is with us.
was Rav Steinsaltz the first to actually present Rashi in traditional script as opposed to what we know as Rashi script?
Well, in what we would
call the Steinsaltz Talmud?
I think in the standard Steinsaltz, meaning certainly in the classic edition of the Steinsaltz Talmud.
Is it still Rashi's script in the classic?
It's still in Rashi's script.
Oh, I didn't even realize that. Wow.
Let me check.
And both and Rashi and Tosfos are both in what we would call Rashi's script in that edition.
Yeah, Rashi is in Rashi's script.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize
and
that.
Tosfot is not in Rashi's script.
That's in traditional script.
Right. But I'm saying Rashi remained in Rashi's script for no other reason than to differentiate between Rashi and Steinsaltz's Perush.
But the funny part about all this, Rabbi Schreier, is that I'm sure people are criticized when, in fact, literary works do change back, let's say, to the traditional script or the traditional way it was written, when in reality, that's going back to the way it was. That's...
Listen... there's certainly a tendency among certain aspects of the Jewish community to say that everything that exists today always existed.
Right.
And you know, anything that diverges from that what we're used to or what we say always was is heresy.
Right.
You know, go fight with it. That's the way that it is. So no, send them. But you know, Rashi, the Heliger Rashi script is the Heliger Rashi script. There's nothing to do about it. It's not a,
Finally, the whole issue.
I mean, between you and me, yeah. One of the major criticisms of when Rav Steinsaltz first came out with his Gemara,
right,
was that he abandoned the Vilna Daf.
Correct.
Meaning
He created a Steinsaltz format.
Right.
Right.
Now, again, this doesn't go back to the days of Rav Ashi and Ravina. I mean, it's not a...
Although we're probably taught that it was, but okay.
With all due respect to the Almana Rome, it didn't always look that way.
Right. Understood.
So, Sada, no.
Well, with that in mind then, so then finally I ask the question to get your perspective. We're speaking to Rabbi Joshua Schreier. So what about this whole era that we finally got to of somewhat of acceptance of studying Talmud in other languages? In other words, it remaining in Aramaic, which is the basis of this reference guide, right? Without it being in Aramaic, this reference guide would be a lot smaller, right? But the fact that it's in Aramaic and remains so for so many centuries is fascinating to me. At some point, you would think, wouldn't someone have just created a translation into Hebrew, a more common or even in some ways a more studious language for the yeshiva person, right? And at the same time, it just remained the way it always was in Aramaic. Now I would guess we'd have to admit that because of this English revolution, you know, in the Talmudic study, I guess we could say that in some ways many people are studying it in English. But it took a long time to get here.
Again, you know, I have to admit, when I read Dostoevsky, I didn't read it in Russian. You know, I also use translations.
Uh-huh.
But obviously, the original is better. Adding to that, the fact that there are nuances, and if there's one of the main tools that we use in approaching a Mishnah or a Gemara is diuk.
Right.
How can you be mendaic? How can you be, you know, draw inferences
in a different language
from the language in translation? It can't be.
Right.
And these aren't merely in terms of understanding. It's in terms, there are halachic differences in terms of. So I think understanding the original, you know, understanding it in the original, I think is crucial. I have to admit, you know, for 30 years I was a teacher. And one of the things I fought against was crutches and shortcuts. And they say, no, you'll deal with the text and you'll understand the text and that's the way it's going to be. And now I've gone over to the other side. I mean, I don't know if I philosophically went over to the other side.
Right.
Certainly in terms of my employment, I've gone over to the other side. but the point is, I think that it's very important to, on the one hand, make the Talmud as accessible to as many people as possible.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, maintaining the, I don't think sanctity is the right word, but maintaining the integrity of the text.
Understood.
And understanding that the way it was phrased, despite all the changes in Girsaot and the fact that there have been some, I don't believe it's the same text that, because of the people who have copied it and made mistakes, and therefore you have the Bach and the Groh and the various others. But to maintain the integrity of the text, so one can continue to study it. Let me just, I don't know where the right place to put this in is, but my mother was a very, very, as you know, was a very, very avid listener of your radio program.
We remember her fondly.
Yeah, she's gone now for a little over a year and a half, and I'm only sorry. I can only imagine how much she would have enjoyed hearing me on your radio show, so it's not that.
I very much appreciate that, and I'm thankful to the one above that we were able to reunite in this fashion. By the way, lastly, could you humor me? You said earlier in this conversation that Rav Steinsaltz is there essentially in the role, in many different roles, obviously, but in such a supervisory role that you would only approach him when there's a dispute, a controversy. I say that in the nicest way, obviously. Something that really has to be brought to his attention in regard to the way you and your colleagues either want to translate something, present something, etc. Could you give me an example of a time recently where you went to Rav Steinsaltz to discuss an issue that had to be hashed out in order for it to end up the right way on the page?
Well, I'll share with you an issue that we're discussing now.
Okay.
And this has to do with certain halachot that we find in the Gemara. I won't go into too much detail, but certain halachot that we find about treatment of Gentiles, where... let me just preface it for a second.
Sure.
There are a lot of people who take certain parts of the Talmud and about the attitude towards Gentiles, and they say, oh, look at this. They're terrible. How could they say these things? I always console myself by saying the Gentiles in that period were killing the Jews, and the Jews took revenge by sitting in the Beis Medrash and saying svaras.
I mean,
let's put it in a little perspective. But basically, to while avoiding apologetics, while avoiding coming up with all sorts of lame excuses why it appears that way, you know, as opposed to come up with a way that would be more better received by the public in general. Let's put it that way. And, you know, these nuanced discussions are things that Rav Steinsaltz is uniquely, he's definitely a person who
right.
will have something.
To say he's involved with these types of discussions.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. We don't know how he's going to rule yet, do we?
No.
Let us know. Rabbi Schreier, this has been an absolute delight. Mazal tov to you on the release of the brand newly revised reference guide to the Talmud, the indispensable Talmud study aid. I'm sure a lot of people will have this right next to their Talmud as they continue to plow through the pages of the Talmud. Kol hakavod to you and Simchat Purim to you.
Same to you. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. There he is, Rabbi Joshua Schreier from Israel. He is the editor of the newly revised edition of the reference guide to the Talmud. Check it out. Rabbi Adin Evan Yisrael Steinsaltz has an indispensable resource for students of all levels. For improved usability, this completely updated volume has a number of brand new features, topical organization instead of by Hebrew alphabet, re-edited and revised text to coordinate with the language used in the current Talmud Bavli, and an index of Hebrew terms to enable one seeking a Hebrew term to locate the relevant entry. This fully revised English language edition of the reference guide clearly and concisely explains the Talmud's fundamental structure, concepts, terminology, assumptions, and inner logic. It provides essential historical and biographical information and includes appendices, a key to abbreviations, and a comprehensive index. It is an excellent companion for anyone studying Talmud. Rabbi Schreier is the editor of this newly revised edition, and I thank him for joining us. I remind you that Koren Publications brings you this segment in its first run Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, and of course at assorted times on our stream at jmnam.org and nachumsegal.com. And I also remind you that Magid Books is an imprint of our friends at Koren Publications, and they are dedicated to bridging the dialogue between religious Israeli scholars and the American Jewish community. Magid Books authors include Rav Amital, Rav Steinsaltz, Rav Binyamin Lau, and many more. Ask about Magid Books at your local Jewish bookstore. We continue to highly recommend them. You have been listening to this edition of Buy the Book right here at the Nachum Segal Network. I thank you all for tuning in and for being part of this presentation each and every week. Don't forget, we have incredible programming all day long on the stream. Make sure to be tuned in to jmnan.org and nachumsegal.com at all times. Wishing everybody Simchat Purim, a very happy and wonderful Purim holiday. You've been listening to the Nachum Segal Network.